Hi, this is Lex, and welcome to the FinTech Blueprint. It's your podcast about fintech, decentralized finance, digital banking, investing, robo-advice, artificial intelligence, and all the other frontier technology that is transforming financial services. To get more content, like an illustrated transcript of this conversation in your inbox, subscribe at fintechblueprint.com. So without further delay, let's jump into today's episode. I am so excited for today's conversation on the podcast. We have with us Aaron Shum, who's the founder and CEO at Vestwell, a good friend of mine, and I'm really excited to talk to him about digital wealth, retirement, and all things fintech and financial services. Aaron, welcome to the podcast.
Yes, thank you. Really happy to be here and awesome to catch up here a bit. Lex and I were just chatting quickly offline and it's been a minute since we've had a chance to reconnect here. So it's awesome.
Absolutely. I'm cheating. Two birds with one stone. But you have a fascinating story and I'm excited to share it with our audience as well. Can you maybe just open up how you got into, you know, what's now called fintech, but probably wasn't when we all started? What pulled you into this industry and kind of how did you get that first interest and your first start?
Yeah, it's an interesting story and I'll make it brief, but the long story short was I moved to New York in 2002 with aspirations of becoming an asset manager and going in down that rabbit hole. And I did not get a job in the space because people were all using a particular software in the separately managed account world, which is kind of where I had gravitated towards, that was built by CheckFree APL. And there was Fiserv and then Tegra 118 and is now part of InvestCloud, to give you the lineage there of the company. But at CheckFree, I interviewed there and they hired me to come in as a business analyst and then became a product developer. So my mindset was like, hey, I'm going to go learn this software that everyone's using. And then I'm going to go into the asset management world. And that was really kind of where I cut my teeth and then just got sucked into the tech side and thought, hey, this is really interesting, and kind of looked at it like a clean sheet of paper of designing things and what you could build. And for those of you as old as me, you'll appreciate the kind of like old blue screen DOS mainframe type structure that it was built on. And that was our sheet of paper, right? But you could do a lot of really powerful things with it. So I started my journey there, really liked the fintech world, got burnt out and left that business and co-founded a fintech platform in the wealth space that was called Folio Dynamics. And Joe Marac and I, who was my boss over at CheckFree, we both left to go build that. And, you know, really with the impetus of trying to change a lot of the things that we felt constrained by within the CheckFree platform and how we could bring this world together and create a better holistic wealth offering. So we built that business, you know, powered upwards of 100,000 advisors, about 800 billion in assets across 5 million individual wealth portfolios. And kind of through the iteration of that, I ran product for that business and I ran revenue for that business. And then strategy, we did a couple acquisitions along the way. And about 3 years in, so that was in 2007, we started that business. Market collapse, which is a whole nother story that was a struggle to get through. Pulled it out. 2010, we had about 30 employees and our employees needed a 401k program. So as being a principal of that business, went through the steps of actually going out and, you know, finding someone to help us with a plan to the employees. And I lived firsthand how painful and challenging it was. And that was what spawned the idea of like, hey, we could go build a retirement platform and then marry it into the wealth platform we were already building and kind of cross that bridge. And our investors at the time were like, hey, that's a really interesting concept, but let's stay focused on the wealth side. We got enough to do here. So I did, stayed focused there. We sold that business at the end of 2014. And I just couldn't shake this notion of trying to go fix the retirement side and what I had lived and kind of understanding how these things are wired together. So that was it.
Yeah. So if it's only that easy to get into a $1 billion idea, as you make it sound, let's meditate a little bit on CheckFree and Folio Dynamics, which, you know, was acquired by Envestnet. And then, as you mentioned, CheckFree has a pretty
cool pedigree, you know, joining Fiserv and then continuing to evolve. You mentioned a couple of different words, and I want to just open them up and in terms of what they mean. And so I think those are things like separately managed accounts and trading and rebalancing, and then other things that you did for advisors and broker dealers. Can you talk about the types of things that, in either case, the technology was solving, other than just giving you a blue screen to code on?
Yeah, so it's a blue screen with linear processing. So a separately managed account, just to kind of boil it down for those who are less familiar, is really, let's say you have, you know, I don't know, it's called $100,000 to go invest, and you have some sort of, you know, advisor or whatnot that you're working with. Rather than just go buy a bunch of mutual funds, separately managed accounts allowed an individual to have their own portfolio within that kind of that construct managed by someone, right? Be it a Franklin Templeton or whoever, right? Could step in and be that portfolio manager in that regard. PIMCO, all of these folks were doing it. So that was the idea, is create the, kind of these custom portfolios. Then it grew into this idea of what we called multi-strategy portfolios at the time, MSPs, that is now known in the industry as unified managed accounts, UMAs. And that unified managed account construct was really the idea of having a bunch of these separately managed accounts all lined up underneath an individual's household, right? Or an individual's account sitting at the top. So you could have a fixed income manager with a growth manager all managing a single individual's portfolio and coexisting within there and managing it in a tax efficient way, where you're, you know, swapping tax lots and whatnot across the various portfolios if they had like holdings and so on. And that was really what was kind of driving the growth in the wealth business, and where it actually largely still is in many ways today in various forms, right? Whether it be, you know, true separate accounts or unified managed accounts, or, you know, it's kind of the next step of what came out of the mutual fund wrap program, right? Which was, you had several funds bundled together to create a diversified portfolio, you know, packaged up and wrapped together. And that's what became the individual's portfolios, and then took it out to actually having individual stock holdings underneath.
So how does, and you've done a lot more development on this idea with Folio Dynamics, which was quite unique in the space for its ability to handle this complexity at scale. I mean, it's sometimes hard for folks to understand how difficult householding is and how difficult customization is. And, you know, these companies were doing bespoke customization at very large scale to, you know, to the tune of the $80 billion that you're talking about, $800
billion. Yeah, there was a lot of cash flowing through there. The scale was one of the more unique things, right? Because these were, when you think across these portfolios, not only the holdings, right, but you would have all the underlying tax lots for each holding, right, which could be in the tens to even a thousand different tax lots for an individual. And then, you know, pushing a button and rebalancing tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of accounts across a bank's entire list of clients, and having that optimally search for the best tax lot to buy and sell and swap and do all that and track it all the way through the portfolios. It's incredibly complex. I have promised myself and my family I will never try to do that again. But it really does add a lot of value, but it was hard, right? Especially too, when you think back to, you know, the era in which that was built, there was no AWS, right? There was no Azure, Google Cloud. I mean, these things were done, really, you had racks of servers processing this stuff, right? And trying to do it efficiently. It took a lot of effort to try to optimize things like that.
Yeah, the tooling was definitely, let's say, far from where it is today. You know, just, I think it was a couple of days ago, Goldman Sachs announced that it's putting a whole bunch of its financial processing into the Amazon cloud. You know, so you can get treasury as a service from Goldman, or you can get data analytics as a service from Goldman. And that's taken 20 years to get there.
It's night and day from where we were to now. And, you know, this is partly what keeps me really excited about this space, is the iterations we've taken to get here, and the pace at which we can go now, and the ease of implementing these things and building them out, whether they be tools that you're calling or going to try to build natively yourself. There's a world of potential out there, which also creates a world of complexity, because you're like, what do I actually do? Where do I start when I want to build something or create an offering?
One of the things I always wanted to talk to you about in regards to sort of these earlier wealth themes is that, you know, when you were building these SMA rebalancing tools and I was focused on robo-advice, there was also a very large sort of underlying trend, which was the shift to ETFs. And so the things that people were buying in the portfolios started to look quite different as well, because again, if you look in the mid-2000s, it's hard to get exposure to some of these particular investment trends, right? If you want to go international sort of micro caps or things like that, you had to get pretty specific. And now you have so many ETFs and other wrappers that are much more liquid and some of which are more passively managed. And that's really flipped over the structure of the asset management industry. How do you think about the role of these investment instruments, the ETF investment instruments, and then the role of SMAs and advisors? You know, and I think another thing to sort of throw into that mix is more and more direct indexing capabilities that folks are valuing. Like, how does that shake out in your mind as it relates to the ability of advisors to provide advice, like what kind of structures they use, what kind of tech they use, and so on?
Yeah. No, I mean, this is the question that's forever been thrown out there in our generation. So where I see this evolving to, right, is with the proliferation of investment availability, right? Whether that be, you know, the newest iteration of a separately managed account or having an ETF designed around any theme you could pull out of your brain, you know, it becomes easier and easier for people to gain accessibility to these offerings. And then it becomes this race to zero, right, that we've seen. And you're looking at a Vanguard or a BlackRock, right? And the fees keep dropping and keep dropping. And how do you compete? How do you get scale? I think what we're seeing and what I think will actually play out is largely these asset management products, because of accessibility and whatnot, go to zero, right? From a fee perspective, or something close to zero. And it's going to be really imperative for asset managers and these product manufacturers to start differentiating on technology and engagement around whoever the consumer is, right? Whoever's on the other side. And we said that for a long time, and it will take still a long time to fully play out, but I do think it's there. Now, the role of the advisor is ever shifting. You know, it has shifted from before, like the traditional broker. I think back to my days, like internship at Everett Securities, which is, you know, part of Wells, Wachovia, and sitting with the brokers and the desks there, right, and just dialing for dollars and you know, selling stocks. You know, those days are gone. Right. Those have been gone for a while. Rules have changed. Regulations have changed for the better. And, you know, then it moved into more kind of fee-based advice, right, which we're seeing and sitting on top. Rather, it's investment advice or individual advice and wellness. I think the advisor is going to be really imperative in helping from a planning perspective and a wellness perspective across an individual. And in the workplace, we see it actually, it's grown. Right. In 2008, there was, in retirement plans, specifically in the workplace savings offerings, 68% of workplaces had an advisor affiliated with that overall business. Now that has grown to over 93%. So the advisor importance continues to expand, but that role in the way they're engaging is shifting. And there's a lot of value they can bring to the table, but they have to rethink what value they are bringing to the table in the construct. It's not just stock picking.
Yeah, absolutely. And to your point, the sort of value is almost less structural as technology eats away at more of the functionalities around the instruments that people are investing in and how smart they become. I spent a bunch of time in the last 5 years, like looking at things that are adjacent to digital investing, and recently just been fascinated by some of the strange things going on in the capital markets. This is a story I'm stealing from Paul Rowdy of Alphacution, who's done, I'd say, like the seminal work on this stuff. But it's the idea is that the capital markets are essentially splitting into two types of animals. The first is these giant fund complexes like BlackRock and Vanguard, which are, they go to infinity in AUM and pricing goes to zero as an asymptote. And so they're kind of like these giant tankers in the night, you know, they're just moving and turning assets. And then on the other side, you've got the Citadels of the world. So the trading's not really even happening on exchanges, like on the New York Stock Exchange. It is going through Robinhood into, you know, via payment for order flow as a marketing acquisition cost into, you know, Citadel's liquidity pools. And so you're kind of, the thing in between is just not even there anymore. You know, to me, that's so interesting and bizarre because it's so hard to project the impact of that on the other side of the advisory business. I don't know if any of that kind of filters up to your world.
So yes and no, right? I think your assessment is accurate, right? And we see the same thing. It does start to bleed over into like the workplace offering, right? At Investwell, right? And we're offering workplace savings programs, and you get the, depending on the demographic you're servicing, right? Be it, you know, our demographic skews a bit younger, right? So you get people interested in, you know, crypto offerings, in student loan debt repayments and whatnot. And, you know, so they're oftentimes, you know, an individual is looking and say, well, I have a Robinhood account. I can go buy these stocks and go do this and go trade, you know, blockchain constructs. In the retirement world, because it's still, when you think about the ERISA side and 401ks in the States, right, and managing in that regard, there are limitations to what you can offer and how, right? And it has to be a 40 Act product like a mutual fund or ETF or CIT. And so you can't just go do stock picking, right? And so you have to kind of teach people like, hey, this is not that world, right? This is not, it's like when people reach out and they need a loan or something from their 401k, oftentimes they think of that workplace savings program like it's their own personal bank account, right? And there's a re-education you have to put in people's minds like, hey, what you're doing in a direct brokerage capacity and playing around and stock picking is not how it works in an ERISA, you know, a regulated environment. You know, it's structured intentionally to try to allow for long-term savings in a more optimal way.
Yeah. So I see that you fulfilled the promise of getting out of SMAs by going into a place where, you know, the regulatory barrier is there to keep you focused on things outside of. Yeah. So this is a perfect transition to telling the founding story of Vestwell and, you know, the journey you've been on. And if you could also help us understand a little bit the structure of the industry that you're building in, that would be fantastic.
Yes. So I kind of started earlier in giving a little nugget of how I got the idea to do this. And this industry, when you peel it back, so when I say industry, I mean retirement-centric, defined contribution, defined benefit world, is very archaic. You know, people will wrap things and put different skins on top. But at its core, it's largely been the same for decades. And industries have evolved, right? Companies across the United States have evolved. Our parents' generation versus our generation versus our kids' generations, right? There's a shift all over the place with how people view working, right? And what they're going to do. And our parents' generation, you know, it's largely, you know, people worked at their corporate company for their entire careers. And they had a pension structure. We all know what happened to that, right? The pension structures disappeared in the United States and they really became unsustainable. So a shift in that was to the 401k aspect, which is basically contributing from your paycheck into a tax-deferred savings vehicle through the workplace. And then your employer offering some elements of savings alongside of you to help match that and kind of offset the traditional pension era where it was largely funded by the business itself. And that's all great. And in the industry, you know, that was enacted in the 70s and still enacted today. But again, the businesses being served have changed underneath. So when we set out to build Vestwell, it was really solving this specifically through small and mid-sized businesses, because knowing the markets has shifted, knowing that the mindsets have shifted, people are working in smaller businesses more and more. There was a gap in the savings specifically targeted towards those small businesses and the employees of them, because they weren't offered the ability to save in the same manner that our parents' generations were in large corporations where there were, you know, high scale savings instruments there in the platform. So that's what we set out to do, and doing it really from the inside out, right? And not just going out there and say, hey, we're just going to go build a cool solution and go target small businesses and knock on a bunch of doors. We actually went at it and said, hey, we're going to build a solution that solves workplace savings for small and mid-sized businesses through the folks that are currently engaged with small businesses or through distribution partners that want to be in small businesses, right? That maybe are doing some element of it today, but really want to create a holistic offering of everything out there. So that's what we set out to do. And that's kind of how I got here. And it's, as you alluded to, it is very complicated. It is heavily nuanced. And there are so many iterations to what's actually out there versus what you should do.
It's almost like you had founded and ran and successfully exited a B2B2C company before in the fintech space.
There are.
What a strange coincidence.
Right? There's a... Through all the beating your head against the wall and saying, why am I in this space, to actually learning something from it and saying, hey, you know, there's another problem we see here. Once you're inside the beast, right, it's like, hey, we could see where these things started to fall down. And, you know, that's kind of what I took and said, you obviously know the robo space better than anyone, right? And I was looking and say, hey, there's a market for that. But there's also this largely underserved market that already exists through the traditional players that are already out there. And I know the traditional players and I know how they're wired and I know where the pain lies. So let me go try to build something to alleviate that pain and everyone can benefit, you know, from the offer.
So I'm thinking of two questions and I don't know the order in which to ask them. I mean, the first thing I want to ask is just, how are you doing? There was this fantastic raise that you recently completed and an acquisition. And so, you know, anything that you can share about the scale of the company and how the journey is going. And then the second question I'm thinking about is around things like, what's a record keeper? You know, I'm like, what is the shape of the company as it's being built and developed and sort of define the role that you play in the ecosystem? So let me give those to you to weave together as you see fit.
Yeah, so I'll start with the latter. So what is record keeping? I often say, who cares? No one should really care, right? And no one should know. It doesn't matter, right, in the grand scheme of things. But for the folks listening here, a record keeping, think about it, is the underlying engine, portfolio accounting, sub accounting, that is tracking all of the businesses and the underlying employees and cash movements, cash types, investments, elections, and so on, trading, rebalancing, so on, right? And then that sits on top of an executing broker and a custodian. So the custodian is who's ever housing the assets from a legal sense. So that's what record keeping is. Now, I'll kind of weave it into how we're going here or how we're doing. But when this industry is $30+ trillion of currently invested assets, in the small business sector, there's a couple $1 trillion that are currently invested, but there's only about 600,000 workplace plans offered through 30+ million small businesses. So there's only a tiny fraction of businesses in the small mid-sized segment actually have something available to their employees. And the reason why is because it's cost prohibitive, it's inflexible, and it's often very confusing and clunky for a business owner to put something in place for their employees and themselves. And that is largely because of the record-keeping technology that they were all sitting on. Most of this industry is really powered by a very small handful of providers. On the back end is usually an FIS solution, which is the old SunGard, for those of you that are old enough to remember those guys. And they run a huge portion of this industry, right? So like Prudential, DeSolda, Empower, Prudential is powered by an FIS solution. DST was acquired by SS&C. You know, they're the back end of like a T. Rowe Price, right? Or someone like that, for those of you familiar. And then in a census, right? And a census is the back end of Vanguard for small businesses. Those technologies were built decades ago, right? And they're very expensive to operate. So it's driven the cost to serve up. And as small business sectors have expanded, there's been a need to drive down the cost to support that so people can save optimally. So what we endeavored to build at Vestwell was really a solution to help become the next generation for how these things were built on. And we started with kind of the underlying, what's called the 401k, 403b segment, with the idea that we would expand into other aspects and other things that can be incorporated into the workplace from a savings aspect, be it IRAs, right, or natural progression. And then you have 529s for college savings or education savings. Then you have ABLE programs for individuals or family members with disabilities to save on a tax-deferred basis. Then you have health savings accounts and emergency savings accounts. And the way I distill that in my mind is we want to be the engine that powers anything workplace related that you can deduct from someone's paycheck before it goes to their individual account. And the market is there. The appetite is there. Everyone's asking for it. And it just has gotten, it's just gone faster and faster, faster than we thought it would go, right? And we've intentionally taken the long road in many ways where we said, hey, we're actually going to do this from the inside out. We're not going to pour a bunch of sales and marketing dollars on top to try to build a brand and create a reputation out there. We're actually going to go to large partners, install ourselves as the point of access, and then grow the business from there. That in and of itself and doing large enterprise scale solutions is difficult. And you've lived that and been through that pain. You know, it takes a certain glutton for punishment to do so, but it has worked well. And things have just gotten faster and faster. And I think COVID also accelerated a lot of that because there was no longer the ability for an advisor or someone to go sit with a small business owner and try to help engage them. It became a digital first type strategy in many ways. At today, we've, you know, 2021's been remarkable. 2020 was scary, but then turned out to be remarkable. You know, this year we're growing. Typical month, year over year month tracking is about 3 to 4x what it was last year, which, and we anticipate that to continue to be at that pace next year as well. We have just shy of 25,000 small businesses that we're powering. And I want to say, I'd have to go look, and don't hold me to this entirely, but I think it's about 165,000 savers, right? 165,000 individuals that are currently saving. And again, we expect that to grow at the same pace next year. So that's been exciting. And it's just been accelerated more than ever. Just to give you kind of quick, so we go out and we engage with distribution partners that I would put in three broad forms: financial service partners, payroll, HRIS partners, and state savings partners. So government offered programs. And all of those, they're not mutually exclusive. There's a ton of overlap across each of those, but they are the ones that are primarily engaging with these small businesses to help them set up some sort of workplace savings program for the future.
Super cool. And congratulations on things clicking like this. It's a cumulative game, and the investment into it takes a lot of calories and persistence. So hats off on that. Can you talk a little bit about Someday and the acquisition there and sort of how that fits into the overall strategy?
Yes, sure. So Someday is a wholly owned subsidiary of BNY Mellon. Think of it as kind of their digital first offering. And Someday was going out and working with states to power 529 college savings programs and ABLE, which are 529A programs. And they were doing that. And the states then said, hey, listen, we're building up a great base with these programs. Why don't we look to help curtail the savings gap across the states, right? Because what happens is the individuals aren't saving enough, as we all know, right? We have a big savings gap in the United States. And when those individuals don't save enough, and then they're, you know, footed with a big hospital bill or something happens to them that's not planned and that they can't afford, the states have to typically pick up the bill for that, right? And the states are saying, hey, listen, we don't have enough cash as it is. You know, we're already running short. How do we enable people to start saving and kind of, you know, effectively force them to save? So they enacted what they, you know, it's largely known as Secure Choice, saying, hey, if you're a business of X size and you don't have a workplace savings program in place today, you know, a la 401k or 403b, the state mandates that you offer an IRA, right? A payroll deducted IRA to the individual employees. And BNY Mellon approached us in the early days of Vestwell and said, listen, we heard about what you guys are doing. We like it. We don't have the ability to connect with payroll partners in the manner that Vestwell does. Could Vestwell become part of this offering to work with Someday to go offer state savings programs? So we said, sure, we could do that. So BNY Mellon invested in Vestwell. We endeavored to do that. We've been largely successful in engaging with these states. One's live. Two of them are in pilot right now. Oregon Saves is the big one that's live. And through doing that, obviously got to know the Someday team really well and what we're doing. We linked up our platforms. We integrated everything together. And Someday had big aspirations of what they wanted to go do and what they wanted to go build. But as you know, for those of you who have worked in large financial institutions, it's often, you know, a struggle to try to get resources to go build things and go fast and whatnot. And they said, you know, so I made the pitch to BNY and said, listen, we're already doing great things together. We're a tech company at Vestwell. Why don't you allow us to take the Someday business and take the people and the clients and the technology and accelerate it, still in partnership with BNY Mellon, but allowing each of us to focus on what we do best, right? Vestworld being tech arms and legs, if you will, and BNY Mellon doing asset servicing and custody. So, you know, through a lot of conversations, this did not happen overnight, right? This is at least a year of discussion, right? For formal kind of proposal till now of going through this process. And we made it all happen. So we're so excited about it. And how it plays into this, right, is kind of back to what I said before. We want to power all things workplace. So we have the 401k and 403b aspect. We have the IRA piece. We just launched right with the state of Oregon to start. Someday came with the 529 and the ABLE programs. So now we basically leapfrog down our roadmap of program offerings. And we could take the core offerings that were being offered via the state partners and then start to incorporate those directly into workplace savings. So then as an individual, I'm an employee, right, of XYZ company, and I have a 401k through my company. And Vestworld knows, based on the employee data that comes over from the payroll provider, you know, beneficiaries, tax rates, all of these things that are incorporated, we can help those individuals then make better, conscious, educated decisions without having to be experts as to how much they could save in other aspects. You know, do you have kids? Do you want to start saving for college, right? Most people know they need to save for school for their kids, right? Depending on where you live in the world, in the US specifically, you do. And, you know, but most people don't know of a 529, right? Only 60% of people know are saving or want to save. 30% only know of a 529, right? And then there are only 10% are doing it through the workplace. But when you offer through the workplace, there's a huge lift. There's a 50% lift of an individual engaging, right? So we look at this as a really incredible opportunity to help people save in a really efficient, educated manner without having to be experts, and power all aspects of those investment programs behind the scenes.
I have so many questions I want to hop in there with, but also I'm worried of creating chaos in the conversation. But here's a couple. One is, in terms of the investment philosophy that gets applied, you know, it feels like you've built a platform that's really flexible and is also is focused on a lot of different integration points. You know, and this for me goes to, you know, selling asset allocation on its own isn't really enough value proposition. It's the workflow, the account opening, the like goal orientation, being able to pull some part of a paycheck on an ongoing basis. Like all these things are actually the hard thing, not necessarily the investment philosophy. Mm-hmm. But people only see the investment philosophy. So, you know, they'll say, where are the investments coming from? And I think also people have this sense that retirement plans are overpriced. You know, the investment philosophy you'd get in a 401k compared to that similar asset allocation in a brokerage account, you know, you're going to get this big pricing differential. How does Vestworld think about asset allocation? Where does the asset allocation come from? And then, you know, how is it implemented?
Yes. So from the investment side, we are completely open architecture, right? So we don't sell investments. We don't push investments. We basically make a large list available, right, to pick from. And it's typically left to the decision of either the financial institution, right, from a home office perspective, or an advisor, one of the distribution partners, right, where they're saying, hey, this is my philosophy. This is what I like to do from an investment allocation standpoint. This is what I like to make available. And I want to, you know, they're have an ability to educate around that. So we just make it available. Right. We say, hey, you pick and choose what you want. You know, we as Vestworld have an RIA called Vestworld Advisors. We try not to use that. Right. There's only a small portion of our clients actually use that. And it's really just for people who ask for it. They're like, hey, I need something now and I want to go and I don't have a current philosophy, so I'll just use yours. So that's kind of our philosophy there. Now, the asset manager world is changing, right? And you got wellness starting to incorporate into that offering and so on. So we built out a proprietary managed account solution back to the early days of my career, right? And melding in a lot of those philosophies and built what, you know, basically the foundation for wellness and planning at an individual employee level. So now they can start to think about other areas of opportunity to save, right? Now, the pricing, to your point around like why it's been so expensive, goes back to really the impetus of Vestworld and saying, hey, why is this so expensive? Why are these fees being charged the way they are? And we were able to really kind of map it back to the technology, because less around the investment side, oftentimes the investments were subsidizing the technology in many ways. And I don't believe in that that philosophy, right? And that approach and say, hey, listen, the investments shouldn't subsidize tech, but there's a lot of moving parts in this world, in this industry that we need to solve for. And we can solve for it through technology. So payroll processing, eligibility determination, loan processing, all of these things that happen behind the scenes. And that's where the true cost comes in, the true operational overhead, the people you have to hire to actually do that. So we said, hey, if we can build tech to drive the cost serving down, we can incorporate asset management at a low cost and drive the overall cost down altogether. Meanwhile, give our partners the ability to help create the optimal solution for the whoever they're engaging with in the business perspective.
That makes a lot of sense and almost terrifying, you know, to think of the business model of the older players, to your point of like, you know, you're paying 90 bips for S&P 500 exposure in part because those checks have to come out of your paycheck. And that may be not nonsense, but sounds very much outdated today. I want to ask kind of a question that's a little bit more focused on the end consumer and just trying to contextualize the experience of people that you're helping, because you mentioned a couple of times, you know, financial wellness. You've mentioned the idea of goals, and that's kind of their parts around that in the software. It seems that always in the air in fintech and in wealth tech and so on, there is the claim, right, of like, we're gonna help the unbanked, we're gonna help people save. Americans are horribly overlevered. That's not necessarily getting better. BNPL, the buy now, pay later stuff, which is kind of catching on, is driving balance sheets up even more. So people are taking out even more credit because it's so cheap and easy and convenient. You know, and on a macro level, the average balance sheet of an American is not really getting better. And then the other side of that is that behavioral triggers and defaults are so important. You know, so like what it is that you're pushed, or I forget what the word is, nudged to do, you know, is what you do by default. And the difference is, you know, two or three times the outcome if you are by default saving or if you have to elect into saving. Can you talk a little bit about some of the takeaways that you have about financial planning, you know, the average American's financial situation and what kind of things work, don't work, you know, and could be possible within this kind of broader wellness topic?
Yeah. So it's the macro theme of this is spot on, right? Of what we need to solve for as an industry, right? And, you know, statistically in the United States, you know, 40% of individuals have less than $10,000 saved, right? That's pretty scary, right? And especially with what things cost nowadays, right? That doesn't get you very far. And people need to save, right? And we have this kind of multi-legged, multi-tiered process by which we have to engage. And we do so intentionally because it in the long term creates a sustainable business that can run on its own. It's always great to say, hey, yeah, we're going to go, you know, fix the underserved, the underbanked, right? The solutions they have. But you have to actually tie that back to building a business that can stand on its own. Because I often say, you know, if we can't do this on our own, ultimately we disappear, and to the detriment of everyone we're trying to help in the long run for, right? And so, you know, from the very first model I built out around this, and actually you saw that model, right? But when I was kicking around this idea of like, hey, we have to build something that can solve this huge problem and build a self-sustaining business out of it in the long run. Understanding it takes a large investment up front, but we have that. All right, so that's that we have. Now it's, okay, how do we actually get businesses to engage, right? Because, you know, workplace savings programs, we often say they're sold, they're not bought, right? We don't wake up in the morning and say, okay, what am I going to do from a 401k perspective? How much am I going to save and whatnot, right? So it trickles down into the participant, right? And the nudges and the notifications, because they all know they need to save. But when do they do that, right? When do you log in? So it's about how do you engage upfront, get people aligned and activated, right? And then how do you continue to nudge them along the way to make better conscious decisions? We think about this stuff all the time, and everyone's different, right? There's no, here's your solution. This fixes it for everyone, right? So we think about there's the plan design aspects of it, like auto enroll and auto escalate, right? So that you're automatically enrolled in your company savings program. The percentage by which you save every year automatically ticks up. We found that that does work, right? That helps, but that doesn't solve it. And we have to go further than that. So it's, you think about, okay, hey, now that we have these other offerings and where we want to be is, you know, having all of those account programs, those savings programs lined up, rather than telling an individual like, hey, how much you want to save for your 401k? How much you want to save for your health savings account, in your emergency savings, right? People generally don't know those answers, right? Unless you're really analytical and you've broken that stuff down, it's hard for an individual to make those decisions, especially if this is the first time someone's saving. So we look at it and say, okay, we have the immediate, we have the long term, and we haven't fully deployed this, and this will take years of iteration. But saying, okay, we know you make X dollars every pay period or annually or whatnot. How much can you save as an individual, right? So back to the building blocks of planning, right, and wellness. How much can you save every paycheck, right? Can you just take out of your paycheck $100, couple hundred, whatever it is, right? And now let's figure out, based on that, how can we optimally deploy those dollars in the most tax efficient, cost conscious way for that individual? Because there's times where an individual shouldn't be in their 401k, right? And maybe they should be in a Roth IRA and they should be in a health savings account, right? And that's what's best for them. But that individual is typically not going to know that, right? So I look at it, it's our job as a provider and a technology solution to help an individual make those decisions along the way. And kind of, you know, I call it being like air traffic controller. Like, we got the dollars, where are we going to land the dollars? What's the best place to land this for each individual? And I think over the long run, that will help close the gap across individuals, right? And two, within the workplace, I think it's underestimated how powerful that point of interaction is, right? And we often say with people's money, right? You have kind of two trusted sources of information, right? You have your bank, your financial institution, your advisor, whoever that may be, right? And then usually when someone offers you something in the workplace, you have pretty high confidence that you should do it, right? And they say, here's your benefits, right? Pick and choose, right? You're like, I should do something, right? And I'm going to go do it. And you have a captive audience to do that. So we're at this kind of unique point of intersection across the financial institution and the workplace to allow people to start to save right there and then carry that with them wherever they may go in life, because things change, just, you know, us as individuals, right? Your life stages change, and we can help to kind of turn those dials and make those decisions along the way.
That's fantastic, Aaron. Thank you for opening that up. And I think that behavioral psychology piece is so fundamental to actually changing the direction of the outcomes that people are able to achieve. You know, next time we're going to have to talk about decentralized autonomous organizations and, you know, how retirement's going to work in DAOs and how to make it all fun and participatory. But I think for today, we've covered a really great set of topics. If people want to find out more about you or about Vestwell, where should they go?
Vestwell.com is the easiest. My email is just aaron@vestwell. Super easy. Track me down. I'm probably too available, but happy to have a conversation. Like I said at the earlier part of this, the evolution and the pace by which we're going and the interest in trying to instill change and have a better outcome across all individuals is moving faster and faster and so exciting. So we're really happy to be a part of it and help drive some of it.
Awesome. Aaron, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you. Really great to see you and catch up here.
Hi, everyone. That's it for this week's episode of the FinTech Blueprint. For more technical deep dives into all things fintech and decentralized finance, check out fintechblueprint.com and grab a free subscription to the newsletter. This is Lex, and I'll see you next time.